Well, this is Thanksgiving weekend in 1980. Daddy's here and Johnny Holmes is here. And I realized that I had Johnny's thoughts, some of them, at the pig roast, but that I had never gotten your stories, Johnny, other than the ones at the pig roast. And so here I've been interviewing lots of lesser characters, shall I say, that have smaller parts in the drama. And so I wanted to get what things that you remembered. And first of all, do you remember when you and Dad and I went and visited your mother when she lived down here, 10, 15 years ago? When did your mother die?
Don't embarrass me, Jackie. It would be about 12 years ago. I don't remember.
We went and saw Sally Holmes, you and me. And Johnny, I'm sure you were with us. And we sat and talked to your mother, and she talked some about those early days teaching school. And she got out of a little cabinet there a diary of a Civil War soldier who had died in one of the prison camps, Andersonville or something like that, and showed it to us. Do you know whatever happened to that diary?
Oh, it's in the family somewhere. I don't know just where it is right now. So, are you sure it was Civil War? I think it was Revolutionary War.
Maybe it was Revolutionary War.
Maybe it's Civil War. I'm not sure. If you can remember, definitely.
I thought it was Civil War, but I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was an old diary. But that doesn't have too much to do with this.
Colin.
Yeah. Do you remember any stories that your mother told about teaching school?
You know, there's a period in people's lives when they probably don't pass on too many of these anecdotes, which would be rather interesting. So I'm afraid I can't fill in too much. I know that where she taught was over in the what is now the quadrant of I-90 and Highway 15. There used to be a little one-room schoolhouse there.
Right there on the edge of the dairy.
No.
Wasn't that the one?
Before she taught there, she taught over on Milwaukee Road on Highway 15.
Oh.
At Morgan School.
Oh.
And she used to walk across fields, apparently, and boarded with Smiths, who lived down the road there. And interestingly, why these family, not ties, but relationships and memories go back a long ways. And Tom Kelly, who is now city attorney, good lawyer here in Beloit, she taught his father. She had his dad in school.
Mm-hmm. Tim Kelly.
Okay, well, you were saying she boarded at Smith's and that...
She taught in this... Of course, all country schools at that time were one room.
Mm-hmm.
And really, that was why it was so hard to get consolidation in the state of Wisconsin. The one-room schoolhouse had been very effective and was very well accepted, very well proven.
Mm-hmm.
So when consolidation was taking place other states, why it was difficult to get it phased in here because there was a lot of respect for the school system in one of the schools in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, Tom's name, I think his name is Daniel T. Kelly, but he's always been called Tom. And his dad, I think, is Daniel Kelly. And I've always known him as Dan.
That's right.
And so that, you know, you start reminiscing, and you look at the present generation and their children, and then remember the generation or two removed, and gosh, it begins to make you think of the old memories that you heard about the Civil War soldiers that were still around a little bit when we were young.
Mm-hmm.
So history,
even when I was a kid, there was one or two that would be riding in the 4th of July parades.
That's right.
Well, then your mother taught down at the school there on the corner of the dairy, too, because that's where Dad went to school and had her.
She must have taught in Morgan School first, and then she taught here. And
as far as Dad can recall, this school didn't have any name. There wasn't a name to that little schoolhouse.
Well, this was always Collie School, wasn't it?
It was District 12, and sometimes they called it Dolan School. But it was District 12.
Did they call it Collie School, too, you think?
I have not heard it called.
I really don't know. Of course, Collie Road, you know, would be typically
named. Might have been, because it was there before Dad, before W.J. had the farm.
I've never heard it called.
You never heard it called Collie School or just District 12, huh?
No, we remember it as Dolan School, really.
Well, that'll be interesting. And then it ended up the schoolhouse on the farm and now down at the Bartlett Museum. And Dad just told me that when he and Mother were first married and came back to Beloit, why, there was some contemplation about fixing up the schoolhouse to live in. But instead, they built a little addition on the little house there that...
Tenant house.
The little tenant house, and that's where we lived up until... Well, I lived there until the start of fifth grade, so that you people had about 13 years there, huh? Was that what you said? And I had about 9 or 10 years there.
This is sort of like the old woman that lived in a shoe. They sort of outgrew it, Jackie.
Yeah, we sure did. Well, now, when did you start to work on the Dolan farm? What was your first job there?
This is a very momentous occasion in my life. On my 21st birthday, I landed a job, and that was Depression times, when landing a job was the accomplishment supreme. It didn't make any difference whether you got paid or whether you didn't very much, but if you had a job, boy, that was real an accomplishment. So on my 21st birthday, I had that achievement, got a job. I always, working for Dolan's, always worked for the milk delivery.
You started right out as a milkman then?
That's right.
On a route. Whose route did you take over, or was it a new one?
I think it was Tom Capps, wasn't it, Ron?
I don't remember.
Yeah, I believe it was Tom Capps who had that route.
Tom Capps worked for you too? I thought just Ernie Capps.
No, it was Ernie Capps. It wasn't.
Who was Tom Capps, his father or his?
That's the younger brother.
Oh, okay, because Dad always kidded around about Tom Capps like a tomcat, you know.
No, this was Ernie. Ernie was probably a little bit more sedated and dignified in life.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, that allowed him to work for Dolan's.
Well, then you started right out on the route.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Do you recall, where was your route? What area of town did you start on?
I actually don't remember the area of town. About half of that route was going through the Freeman Shoe Plant number one.
Okay, that was the one out downtown or the one out on Prairie Avenue?
That was the one downtown.
Downtown.
Yeah. And I probably knew more people by their first name than anybody that worked down at Freeman's, outside perhaps Mr. Freeman. Incidentally, I was on that route when the union was established at Freeman's. And I've expressed it this way before. If they put up a 35-foot wall between the office and the plant, why, they could more effectively have sealed off the relationship that office had before and after the union was established. It was just different. It was black and white day and night.
Hmm.
And not all of the goodwill, but so much of the congeniality that permeated that plant just was lost at that point.
Hmm.
It was really sad to see.
Do you suppose there was much compensation in gains for the workmen through the union, or do you think that they really were worse off after the union came in?
Well, there's really no way to know.
Yeah.
After all, the union did serve a purpose, but in this particular case, it was very obvious that it destroyed something, too.
Yeah. Do you remember any plant stories? Do you have any adventures going through the plant?
Well, you just delivered the milk and collected the bills.
And well, Howard had somebody that stole from his truck.
Well, we used to put padlocks.
You padlocked your truck to keep people from...
Yeah, this... Well, when it was apparent that you were losing something, right? Mm-hmm. You put a padlock in. So...
Tell him why you didn't have to go on the record what Howard did.
I just mentioned Howard's story about the shoe factory.
He's always coming up with stories.
I think he helped to create adventure, wherever he was, Howard.
Well, of course, Howard had a lot more years with you. I only worked for you for about a year and a half or
something. Time.
And so in that length of time, why you just don't have the variety of experiences. Mm-hmm. My experiences were along lighter lines.
Well, have you got some of those to tell me?
Oh, sure. Why didn't you ask about those?
Let's hear about those.
Well, of course, we all remember Ruby.
Tell me about Ruby.
She was the office administratress. And Ruby liked to wear her authority rather prominently, and we didn't always like to bow down to the authority. So at one point, Ruby had sole jurisdiction over the cash box. Nobody could touch the cash box, except that occasionally when you check out in the morning, 3 o'clock or so, when Ruby wasn't there, you needed change, you'd have to be able to get in the cash box. So one morning, just as I was leaving the office about daybreak, I just put the cash box back, picked up some change, put the cash box back, and here was a frog that just hopped across the sidewalk in front of me. Well, you know, in a case like that, it should raise some possibilities, so I picked the frog up and put it in the cash box. And just luckily, really, I was back in the office when Ruby took the cash box out. And I was rather surprised to find the frog. Ruby screamed, and the cash box flew, and the money rolled. I don't know what happened to the frog, but we all enjoyed it. Another one of the early morning escapades. Got ready to leave, and it was kind of a clammy time of day. You just had to work a little bit harder in order to look for something that was interesting at that time of day. And just as we went out, I happened to look at the electric clock on the desk, and I wondered if it would run backwards. Well, it would. That electric clock would run backwards. You'd have to stop it, and I don't remember just what the procedure was to start it running backwards, but that one would run backwards. And as I heard the story, the barn help came in to breakfast. And Griff came into the office for something and saw the clock running backwards and scared the daylights out of him. He came shrieking out of the office. The clock was running backwards.
As if something cataclysmic had happened in the world to send the clocks going backwards. Time.
So we missed that one. Another memory I have was that when you had a job, you had credit. And when you had credit, you could buy things. So that's how I got my first decent car. I had the job, and I could borrow enough money to buy a car, pay it back $10 a month at the Second National Bank, which is now the First National Bank. And so I had this spiffy Adelaide car. At that time, my radios were just the new thing for cars. And with a little more saving, I got a radio on. And of course, the bigger the area, the more obvious it was. So it had a pretty good sized area. And I had a little problem because getting loaded out at 1 o'clock in the morning is a little bit difficult when you were energetically dating a girl that you attended, right? Mm-hmm. So I used to just carry my work clothes along, and I'd drive into Dogan's and park the car and change my clothes and load my truck and be on my way. And this particular Sunday morning, I looked out of the office. I was checking in. I had my last night's clothes, Saturday night clothes, all pretty well laid out in the car. And the car was parked in front of the office. And I was checking in. I looked out of the office door, and Eddie came up the driveway and looked the car over and looked the aerial over. And he needed a closer look, so he looked inside and saw that all my Saturday night clothes were pretty nicely folded and so forth. And he looked in the office and just stood there, and his shoulders drooped a little bit, wagged his head. I can just imagine what he was thinking. What's this generation coming to?
He knew that you hadn't gone home between your date and your job, right?
Just so when we think of, you know, the younger generation, I guess the younger generation is always supposed to be a little shocking.
Was there any smile at all on his face, or was
very
it mostly
serious,
very serious?
Just sort of resigned. I had expected to have a little conference with Daddy in the day or two, but not on that.
He never said anything about it.
I remember one that we did have, though. We used to have a little competition for loading. And if you'd see a car coming from the west and one coming from the east, why, you try to make the bend into the driveway first so that you got your loading order. And sometimes you didn't quite make it.
Now, wait, a car from the west or a car from the east? You mean somebody that was coming to load?
East direction, sure.
You mean one of the trucks, one of the other route men?
Yeah, usually.
Okay.
So, you know, you didn't like to stand around and wait 15 minutes for somebody else to load.
To unload first,
already,
so if you saw somebody
late.
Coming.
So there's always a little competition. And then as the competition increased, why, we used to occasionally just nudge a truck out of the way. You know, you put a front bumper against a back bumper and somebody was moving in. Pulled him out. And, so this got a little bit strenuous. One morning, while we got a call into the office, seems that Daddy had been standing in the upstairs bedroom watching all of this happen, going out the window. And we had a pretty good truck fight out there. Jack didn't present there for positions to load.
Well, now, I've heard from more than you that Grandpa, standing at his upstairs bedroom window there, was able to command a whole view of the milk house.
Well,
and
sure
that area that went around. You could see the barn, you could see the milk house. He had a strategic bedroom, didn't he, Dad?
Yes, he did.
And the men knew it. And
well, you didn't always know it right away, but you found out after a while.
One of the stories, Lois, is that Grandpa could always tell when the men came in from dates, the men that lived at the house. And then if they came in too late, you see, he would point out that and had to get up at 3 or 4 in the morning to work in the barn, and they didn't get in till 1 o'clock, why, he would call them in and say they weren't getting enough sleep. And I forget which person told me this story, but they figured that if every other night they'd get enough sleep, they could go out every other night and stay out late. And they got so that they would turn out the headlights and come coasting in, and because Grandpa couldn't hear the car, but he could see the headlights. And so when they got to a certain point on Collie Road, they would just turn out the headlights, and then they'd come in, and Grandpa would not have any way of knowing what time they'd gotten in.
Well, you see, my stay was rather limited, a year and a half.
Did you live at the house that year and a half?
No.
You lived at home?
One experience I had with this real nice car, we used to, the cars were a little bit more erratic to drive. The roads are much poorer to drive on. And one morning on the way to work, I hooked a snowbank and flipped the car over up in front of Bumstead's. And Mrs. Bumstead was the next best thing to present day early morning announcer on the radio. And she liked to know the latest, the first.
On the radio?
On the telephone. And so this particular morning, I just flopped this Model A right open in the middle of the road up in front of her house. And so I went in and knocked on the door. First, there were snowbanks. So that's why it happened, because I got out of track and came out sideways, just hopped over. And went in and asked if I could use the phone. And I called the farm. I got a hold of where the mechanic was and told him I was stuck in a snowbank and he probably needed logged a long chain. And so he brought the truck and the long chain. We maneuvered, so we put the chain over the car and put it on the bottom side. Just gave it a good sharp pull, and the thing rolled back up on its wheels. And cars are pretty durable in those days, and this one just started up and ran. Suffered too much from it. And I drove to work and went to work. It was rather scratched up and dented on that side. And a couple days later, my son was almost dead. Maybe I shouldn't have thought of this. I didn't mean anybody, but the English said, "John, we used our phone the other morning, didn't you?" I said, "Yeah." She said, "I understand you tipped your car over." I said, "Well, that's right." Well, she said, "Why didn't you tell me? I didn't know a thing about it." So that was a challenge. She didn't know anything about it.
And you'd even used her phone, and it was right out in front of her house. That was,
You know where Bumstead's lived, they lived for many nights.
Yeah, that was Bumstead's, right, right up here. Well, then why did you leave after a year and a half?
I had a chance to go in business.
When did you start your own dairy? That was considerably
1938
later?
38 or so. Mm-hmm.
Well, was that what you...
No, what the circumstances there were that Fred Wallace had an opportunity to buy a farm.
Mm-hmm.
And... actually what created, not the opportunity, but the desire was that he had farmed the farm that he owned, and then he had farmed his father's farm.
Mm-hmm.
And his father sold it out from under him. Actually, his father just came out and told him, that, says, "I just sold the farm." That's
a little
that
mean of him.
And so Fred was short of land. And the farm next to him was owned by Merck Packwood, had this Highland Dairy operation there for quite a few years. And in the process of selling the farm, the dairy had to go somewhere, so the dairy went along with it.
Mm-hmm.
And Fred asked me if I would drive the truck if I'd work for him. And I thought it was a good idea if he'd sell me a half interest in it.
Mm-hmm.
So I had two Jersey heifers. Traded the two Jersey heifers as a down payment, $500 interest, which was a half interest in the dairy. And I've lost money since then, too, but it was an easy way to lose it then.
And that was in 1st of March of 1938.
Well, apparently I had, because I was 23 when I was married, and I was married in 37. So I would have worked at Dogan's for more than a year.
About when did you start at Dogan's? About 35?
Well, I'm figuring from age. I started my 21st birthday. That I know. That was a milestone.
Mm-hmm.
And I was married when I was 23, and the following year when I left Dogan's. So that would have been 3 years ago.
So you did work there a little longer then?
Have you ever heard about the experiences that we used to get involved in about Plum's Restaurant?
Tell us about Plum's Restaurant.
Well, Plum's Restaurant was an institution. In fact, there was East Side Plum's Restaurant and West Side Plum's Restaurant. And the West Side was over by the over by the smokehouse, over by the railroad depot.
Okay.
And over by the plant entrance to Floyd Ironworks, which is now Floyd Corporation. And people used to get started on a day's work much earlier in those days than they do now. So from about 5 o'clock until 7, my Plum's Restaurant was just about 3 deep for people waiting to move up to the counter and get a stool.
Mm-hmm.
There's always lots of people, lots of activity. And a few Dogan drivers. And it just seems as though, you know, one thing leads to another. And I remember one experience there where We waited until Roy Beeman went to the men's room, and then we locked the door. There was a hole for some reason on the outside of the men's room door, and it was very prominent. It was right next to the kitchen. It was at the back of the restaurant. Where it was totally visible to everybody in the restaurant. And so we passed the word along. Bob Plum was running that one. His brother's name was Lawrence. Lawrence ran the east side restaurant, and Bob ran the west side. And so we told Bob that the noise that he'd hear from the men's room was something that we shouldn't pay any attention to. And we didn't go into too much detail. But anyhow, we locked Roy in the men's restroom.
Mm-hmm.
Or in the men's restroom. And very, at first, the knock on from the inside was, you know, rather subdued. And it didn't get any attention. And it got gradually louder and louder. And finally, while there was somebody in there that was hollering, "Fire, let me out!" on top of his voice. So then they opened it up, and out came Roy.
Probably very red of face.
Everybody with their eye on the door waiting to see what was happening.
Do you remember who your partner was? What other Dogan driver and you locked him in?
Oh, I don't know whether that was Hank Flory or could have been any of several.
But you guys had stopped there for some coffee or something like that early in the morning.
Oh, that was part of the regular routine.
Was to stop by.
Sure.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm sure that you were here longer than the year and a half that you first mentioned, because so many things happened. They couldn't know all happened in a year and a half.
Well, we had a pretty active group there for a while.
What year were you 21?
What year was I 21?
You were 14.
14. So I was 21, 21 years old. 21 years later.
So you were, it was 1935 when you turned 21 then and came to the dairy. Well, now, were you one of the Tri-Y boys that grew up with Grandpa Dogan? And
yeah, one of my earliest memories, Jackie, is a runaway that happened right in front of the farm where the Rock Barn is.
Let's hear about that one.
And we were driving down the road in this horse and buggy, my mother and my grandmother and myself, and the horse ran away. And when a horse runs away, you see it in the cowboy movie today, and it looked pretty strenuous, but if you're in it, it is pretty strenuous. Mm-hmm. It's a real actual fact why it's pretty scary. And this horse ran away, and of course the buggy whipped around and then went into the ditch, and then it starts to break up, and the harness breaks, and the horse leaves, and my grandmother was thrown out when it went into the ditch. Well, she was thrown out of the buggy, and she struck a tree with her head.
Mm.
And she was unconscious, and she was carried in, I think it was, did Stams live there?
No.
Probably into there.
In the back room, in the side room there that was the office for a while. Stams lived there earlier.
And she was carried in. They probably had the doctor come, but there was nothing that was drastically serious. I think she had some stitches. So that was one of my early memories. Run away in front of.
And you and your mom came through okay. You don't remember injuries to you and your...
People had runaways.
Grandma Dogan had run away, or else she drove into the driveway too fast, and driving a horse named Rock.
Rock, R-O-C-K?
Mm-hmm.
A carriage horse?
Yeah. Well, he served small purpose horse, but he was a little on the rangy side, and he came around the corner in the driveway, and the buggy turned over on his side. He probably possibly wasn't running away, but he was running faster than Grandma wanted him to, and she was thrown out of the buggy.
How old were you at that time?
I don't remember, about too old.
How old were you, John?
I'm mean, you were 10 or under or 10 or over?
Probably 10 or under.
Uh-huh.
Well, I don't know. That's probably 3 or 4 years old.
I've told you, Lois, about the first time I really remember John. I know I've told him. But I was calling at home back there off the road, and on my old school teacher and so forth. And it was about this time of year, and peeking around behind his mother's skirts was this little boy. And he had a turkey drumstick, one in each hand. And first he would suck one and look at me with his big eyes, and then he put that down, and then he put the other one in his mouth. And he just alternated those drumsticks all the time I was talking to the mother.
This was Johnny? This Johnny,
yeah,
sitting here?
Yeah.
Going back before that, and this needs to be told. I don't think that I've ever told you this, Ron. But when I was probably a year to 2 or 3 years old, boy, I had malnutrition. And if it hadn't been for a mother who wouldn't let me die, I would have died, because I was just undernourished. And I still had some effects. I had some big joints and so forth from malnutrition. And at that time, why, I think that the attitude was that, so the kid is weak, so he dies. That's just pretty much the way the world went. And in my case, my mother just did everything that she could think of. And one of the things that was done was that one of the Dogon drivers every other day would bring fresh meat to our house out in the country, and their regular routes, whatever their routes were. And this was all by horses at that time, so it wasn't something that was just a casual, easy thing to do. But it was just, here was this kid that was actually not able to take enough nourishment so that he could live.
Mm-hmm.
And they were doing everything that they could, and one of the things was that having fresh meat, and I think that the juice from the fresh meat was given to me. And this was something that your family helped with.
Well, now, would they bring this meat from town to you because of hard for your family to get in and out of town, or did they bring it from the dairy?
No, it was from town.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, that you didn't have refrigeration. You couldn't stock things like that. So here was something that probably was advised would be helpful if fresh meat, juice from fresh meat, could be had regularly. This could be nourishing.
And here were these trucks that were going back and forth regularly,
well,
these horse-drawn.
It was horses. You see, this was back in, I was born in 1914, so this would have been about 1960 or 70.
So they would have brought out the meat for little Johnny.
That's right. You think in terms of help and welfare and so forth, programs today, but these things used to be done. They used to be done on a voluntary basis, and they used to be done as the way neighborhoods lived, the way they existed, the way they helped each other to overcome their own problems and difficulties.
Mm-hmm. Well, that'll be a nice little addition to the book, because Grandpa surely would have commissioned that. He would have said,
"Oh, absolutely.
Now you boys, you know, pick up the meat at the grocery store," and that would just be part of their route, to pick up the meat and carry it out.
It wasn't a grocery store, because
at the butcher's.
Days, there was no place that you got meat except the butcher shop.
That's right, and it was probably that butcher shop there on Pleasant Street or Public, which was the one where Mother used to get, where you people used to get meat when I was a kid. What was it? Schultz, was that the guy's name, the butcher?
No.
Don't you remember?
Yeah, but I can't.
Might it have been a Scheibel meat market? There was a
back in the mid-teens, nobody would remember.
Well, in the 30s, there was Schultz's that we got meat from, wasn't there, Mother? Schultz meat market?
Burger. Do you remember Burger? Well, that's a fitting name for a meat market. I remember burgers as one of the patronized.
And also, these butcher shops used to have nearby, they'd have what they call a slaughterhouse. And remember Henry Severson had a slaughterhouse over on Highway 15?
Yeah.
And this meat was butchered every day or every second day, and you didn't have the means of keeping it. They would have ice, but that was difficult at times.
Mm-hmm.
And there was another one over on the State Line Road, just out of town. It was a slaughterhouse. These were all just a small building.
I don't remember whether it was First World War or the Second World War, but there was such a meat shortage. And the nurseryman there, Dunn, was quite a character.
Jack Dunn.
Jack Dunn. And he had an arrangement to run out a support from the end of his barn. And he'd get a hold of a steer or something and run the thing out and hang the steer up and slaughter it there and get rid of all the effects. Get rid of the meat on the black market.
Yeah, well, this is where the black market meat came from. Somebody that would butcher, because it was illegal to do, meat was only available on points. There's limited supply of tires.
You're talking about Second World War now or first?
Second World War.
Second World War. Well, this is probably Jack's second. Because he's about my age, so he's been on the top of his vigor.
Well, that's a very interesting story, the meat and the whole refrigeration and business. I've learned from Dad how they would go down to the river and cut the ice for the ice house to keep the loads cold during the summertime. And
no, this was part of the routine. We take the loads in and stop at the ice house. It was river ice, and you chip that over the cases.
Well, this was ice right down that the city had, I mean, that the ice company had stored right down by the river, right?
That's right.
Because there was a certain amount of ice that was out at the farm.
Well, but when that ran out, why then we pick it up in town.
So what would you do, Dad? You'd get as much ice as the ice house would hold, and then when you ran short, you'd buy ice from the ice house in town, and that was right down there by the river, right? I seem to recall the ice house down there. In fact, I seem to recall going and getting ice there once in a great while.
Brannigan's Ice House.
Right next to the river.
Uh-huh.
And they kept it in sawdust.
Well, that was the way it was at the dairy, too. And I can remember climbing up, and the sawdust always was a little bit wet around the ice blocks. You'd dig down to an ice block, and the sawdust would just be a little bit wet around it, which indicated it didn't melt very much in there. And that was always fun.
Well, then we used to buy ice 400 pounds at a time and haul out a couple such blocks every day. That's when we had the bigger refrigeration set up, but we needed that for
mechanical refrigeration.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we bought that snow machine, which we could.
That was always fun.
Cover your loads with fresh snow.
Well, do you have any memories, John, about being a kid in this neighborhood and W.J. and the things that he did? I knew he was active with, were you part of the Y cabin, the Tri-Y cabin out there, or was that after you? Out there in the woods that built that cabin with Roy Beeman.
I think that we were...
You were the generation ahead of that?
Lois and my gang were the generation that started that.
Yeah, we were members.
Yeah, we were.
Eddie Dogan had a wide group of you fellas when you were still in your teens.
Ron did.
Ron, right.
Yeah.
Well, do you remember Ron then as your youth leader?
Well, is the recorder on or off?
It's on, okay, but he doesn't, we'll hear any stories.
We'll keep it clean.
Well, that's all right. I've heard a few that aren't clean.
Actually, Ron, your family, Jackie, has been more of an inspiration, more of an influence than you'll ever know in this area, in this neighborhood. And while Daddy Dogan was rather straight-laced, even in those days, we thought that maybe a little smoking and a few of the things that Daddy didn't approve of at all were a little bit was all right. But as far as commanding respect, Daddy Dogan and your family has created more atmosphere and respect and influence in the neighborhood probably than anybody that has come along two or three generations. And of course, you have seen this, you know, to a greater extent what fields and manners this has happened, but programs of the neighborhood used to be pretty much on its own. The entertainment was a house party, and the fiddler, and somebody that could provide some music, and a house dance, and this was it. And the inspiration, the ideas for something that's new and something that's better in agriculture had to be brought in, sold pretty hard to people. They just didn't have the exposure and the communication that you have today with the farm journals and with the commercial media, which is looking for things that will be helpful to people because this will promote whatever their project is, whether it's television time, whether it's selling more magazines or whatever. And the advancement as far as technique and better methods and better breeding techniques, better crops, were something that were not pushed on people to the extent that they had been in the late years. And Daddy Dogan, later on by your dad, have been in the forefront. And they have had more initiative and they have had more influence than anybody in the agricultural field in this neighborhood. And I say that with full knowledge and total sincerity. It's definitely a fact, so It is nice to be able to express it to you. As far as memories are concerned, yes, I have memories that go back to the old days when...
Just wait one second. What did it start as?
Lone Scout.
And the individual that brought it to my attention was the Hollenbeck boy that drowned.
Merle.
And he had sent for the material, and he had these little books.
From Prairie Farmer.
Where it came from. But anyway, he was working along on those, and it occurred to us some way or other that wouldn't it be nice if we organized a group and met regularly at the homes, had some fun together, and followed this program.
I would guess, and I think that I'm probably fairly right on it, that, you see, this came in early to mid-20s. The Boy Scouts were started in this country about 1914, something like that. I should know, but anyhow, why the Boy Scouting program had taken root in this country and was achieving stature. And I think that the Prairie Farmer was instrumental in starting what was called the Lone Scouts, which was for rural boys. And so this is what you speak of, and I think this is where it came from as far as the start.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was this Merle that was a spark plug.
That got the material.
Material, and got his brothers interested.
Was he a young kid, Merle?
Well, yeah, Ermarl at that time was about 14, 15 years old.
Mm-hmm. And
then it went along for a year or so, and then your dad got involved and interested in it and gave it leadership. And that's today, why these programs are exactly the same. You have the ingredients, which is the youth, but you do have to have the leadership in order to implement the program.
Of course, what happened to these rural groups, like the group that we had in working with the Tri-Y, with better transportation, the kids having cars and folks running the place and so forth, they're just focused on the town. And the days that Johnny and I are talking about, kids didn't get to town, couldn't stay after school in town.
Is this for me or is this for you? It's to show if anybody wants something.
Why don't you give that to Johnny and give me about half that size? Because I've been feeling so full lately. Tell me about Merle who drowned. Is that a story that's got anything to do with anything? I mean, did he drown in Turtle
really,
Creek?
No.
Or?
You see, in those days, why you didn't have the medical facilities, you didn't have the medical knowledge you had today.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just survival of the fittest.
Mm-hmm.
And Merle was found lying face down in a little creek that ran behind their buildings on that farm. And the reason that it seems that he drowned was that he was found in the creek, but the creek was not of the sufficient size for a person to be able to drown.
Hmm.
So he probably died of a heart attack or something.
Might have had a seizure of some kind.
Seizure of some kind.
Might have been epileptic or something.
That's right.
Was he still a kid?
Oh, yes, yeah. He was probably 16 years old.
Huh. Or he might have fallen and hit his head or who knows what tripped
him. Well, that's true, but it
didn't show
it,
that.
It couldn't. Well,
yeah.
It wouldn't have been a drowning in normal sense.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting.
And it was, at that time, just one of those things. It just happened. And must have drowned because they found him in the creek, but there wasn't no water in the creek to drown him.
Well, like his father getting killed by throwing a pitchfork up into a hay mow. Instead of going to hay mow, it hit against the upright and bounced back and went into him.
Good Lord. Good Lord.
Left 12 kids.
I mean, it bounced, it ricocheted back on him.
Yeah.
And one of the tines caught him in the neck.
Caught him right in through a cheekbone.
Through a cheekbone. Good Lord. He had flung the pitchfork up into the
into the loft. Take it, throw it up there, instead of hitting in the hay, and before it was soft, well, I'd hit a beam, and the tines are spring steel. And it just threw it back.
Good Lord. That's one that might go in the book.
Turn this thing off because I want to tell John a story to go.
This was one of the Hombeck brothers. There were two brothers. One was George Hombeck was Erling's Eunice's dad. And
is that?
I think it was.
That's the father.
Was that the father?
I think so.
Then there's a son.
Yeah, but.
When did this accident happen about?
This happened in the late 20s.
So, I see right where it goes in my book then, because I have Marcy not having no way to attract Grandpa's attention except to throw a pitchfork down beside him, but she knows enough not to throw a pitchfork. I imagine that would be a story that would have been prevalent at the time I was a kid.
For about 5 years of my life, mostly the year I was in France, persuading my folks that I should get married over there and that I had my life all planned and what I was going to do and so forth. And in those letters, it shows Grandma and my reference to her and my talking to her, referring to the letter that she sent me. As a very compassionate and woman.
Yeah.
Not the one whose first thought was what's going to happen to me next.
Well, I've told that story and read that story before, and many a woman has said to me she understands grandma perfectly. That after all,
what can all, happen? Huh?
All these things fall down upon the person that's in charge, like tending grandpa and the disaster at the next place and so forth.
Or as Henry Truman said, the buck stops here, huh? It's got to stop somewhere.
Yeah. Well,
the buck really stopped on November, what, 4th? This year?
Stay off of that topic. Well, over the years, you must have had various things to do with WJ, even though you weren't working on the place. Because you were
going back
in Turtle Township and...
Going back, though, Jackie, to when we were just neighborhood kids. See, neighborhoods were different then. They were much more remote. You might live within 5 miles of Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
But you are actually further away than you are 500 miles from the city today.
Mm-hmm.
Because of communication and just the circumstances of life. One of my early experiences that I can remember, another one, was being thrown out of a bobsled in a snowbank. And this was during the flu epidemic, but I think it would have been probably 1918, which would have made me about 4 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And we were going, my dad was going to Beloit, the town, and taking me. We were going to see my mother, who was in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And she was there during the flu epidemic. And the roads, which were filled with snow, and rather than being plowed out, there wasn't equipment for it. You cut the fence to go through the fields. And then this track would build up deeper. We've had the experience here. And then the sleigh tipped over because the hard packed snow was so high, and I was taken into a neighboring farmhouse, which was Gilmore's, which is just south from the old barn next road.
It's been turned into a
nursery
now.
Yeah, and this was during the flu epidemic. Now, at that time, why my mother was pregnant with her third child, and my brother was then about. Probably 6 months old.
Mm-hmm.
And back to how people took care of people at that time, why he was in the home of the Crawfords who lived on Milwaukee Road. I think Mr. Crawford, Jack Crawford's father, was with the college.
Crawford, wasn't it?
I don't know.
Wasn't that the house with the the brick house?
The brick house, that's right.
That Don King lived in later.
Sure. They had my brother. And they were taking care of him. And whatever the organization was, we didn't have any relationship with them, or based on either a blood relationship or friendship, prior friendship. But I can remember being taken there to see my little brother while my mother was in the hospital. Of course, at that time, the casualty rates were high. Everything turned out all right, but that's where he was being taken care of.
I have stories from not as much detail as I'd like about the farm during the flu epidemic, how Aunt Lillian was out milking cows. You know, Lillian Dogan that lived down with Hazel Croft and was out to the farm, and those people that worked on the farm, when Lillian used to come out, said that she was an awful nuisance because she was always around and knowing how to do things better than everybody else. But I guess she really showed her mettle during the flu epidemic because she was out there milking cows and bottling milk, and there were only a couple of people that weren't ill. Wasn't that the story, Dan?
Yeah, I was born in 1918, I'd be 16 years old. So, I had a little flu.
Mm-hmm.
very nearly died of the flu. They gave her so much righteous soup that she hadn't eaten any righteous since. She was down in the school of Southern Illinois. Infirmary was filled. Folks dying about.
All the doctors were dead.
No, that was a terrible time. But Aunt Lillian helped keep the farm going, and they delivered milk every day, in spite of the epidemic.
Well, I had a good friend in a little Putnam in town, and he got me reading when I was a youngster. I mean, he assisted me in reading and found books very interesting. Lowell and I had a great deal of fun together with fighting on bicycles and meeting other gangs and fighting with bicycles with BB guns. But Lowell Putney and his father and his mother and two sisters all died in the flu. Just wiped out that family.
That's just incredible. It's a whole. Did anybody survive from the family?
I don't remember. There might have been a third sister or something, but I lost track of it.
Wow.
So when you think of, you know, things in terms of catastrophes, why they've been happening through the years.
Yeah.
Getting back to the early memories, Jackie.
Yeah, that's what I'd like.
Of course, we all went to the country schools.
Mm-hmm.
And I started a country school. First year I was there, right, they didn't have the new well yet. It's been very controversial because wells cost money. I think this cost $100. But we had to go to the neighbors, which is about a third of a mile away, to get water. And usually why the most favorite students were not given the job to go after water. In other words, that was sort of a penalty trip.
Mm-hmm.
But we always used to try to think of things, you know, like dipping a cat's tail in there, or maybe, you know, if you weren't near to a toilet, you had urinate, right? It was pretty handy and so forth.
The bucket or the...
So, oh, sure.
Oh, good so, Lord.
Did you, John, did you carry the water in open buckets, or did you have these set cans with a cover that pushed down over?
No, as I remember, there were about a 2-gallon can that had a cover that pushed down on the top, so it didn't slop over. But there were a lot of, we had, a very dedicated school board. They were dedicated to saving money. So the first and foremost qualification in hiring a teacher was, what were they going to pay her?
Mm-hmm.
And they always bought the cheapest, always hired the cheapest one. And we could usually, on an average, I go through about 2 teachers a year.
Now, what school did you go to?
This was Zilly School.
Zilly, down there. Okay.
And one teacher, we found out, was maybe allergies or something like that. Anyhow, we'd go out and take a piece of cloth and a magnifying glass and start this cloth when we go to the outside toilet.
Mm-hmm.
We'd start this cloth on fire, and it would just smolder. We put it in ink wells, and then as this progressed, we found out we could get a better accomplishment by just taking matches. You scratch about 6 matches and pop them into an ink bottle and put the cap on. And after they brewed for about an hour or two, about 10:30, right, we just start taking caps off the ink bottles. And usually, right, the teacher would be sick enough by noon, so we wouldn't have any school in the afternoon. And one teacher left because of health problems, but this was the basis of the health problem. And
is there a chemical reaction, you think?
What was it? It was an empty ink bottle. They used to have ink bottles about this big, around about this high. And they had a cork stopper. Well, we used to, when they were empty, right? Mm-hmm. We used to put the matches in. And it's just, what?
It's still burning?
Well, they would smother. You see, the sulfur would burn and it would be a pretty vile odor. And we'd start uncorking the ink bottles about 10:30. The teacher would be sick of our finding, so we would go to school because the teacher was sick. And but we used to be rather hard on teachers.
I don't think we're so rough on them down here.
You couldn't have gotten, Sally Holmes wouldn't have let you get away with that, would she?
Well, she was just a little bit of a thing if we'd had some bully boys in there, we'd have made it pretty tough.
Johnny's mother was Dad's teacher at country school.
One thing that you don't have today, which is really precious now, is this going?
Yeah.
Oh, it's okay. For example, our family, with our three children, grown, have families of their own. And this Thanksgiving, why, rather than be alone, why, we invited ourselves to go to one of Lois's cousins. We were going to have some family. Mm-hmm. And our family is dispersed. One son's in Los Angeles, one son is in Germany, one son is playing in Michigan, which is too far to go for a weekend for Thanksgiving. And yet, before we stopped here this afternoon, while we were at another friend's house, the Gundersons. And Russ Gunderson is a few years younger than I. But I worked for Russ's dad on his farm when I was high school or pre-employment Dogan. And his father had worked for my father when he was younger. Mm-hmm. And so today, well, you have people who are much more transient. You have much more casual attitudes toward people because of the fact that you don't have this
this linking of the generations.
This depth of relationship. Mm-hmm. And when we left, the reason that we were there was that Mrs. Henderson, who was a World War II bride and grew up in Louisiana, has been here all of her married life and integrated into the neighborhood and the families and so forth. But her family's had much more than a normal amount of tragedy. And it seems that...
what's her first name?
Mary Adair.
Mary Adair. Her brother yeah. is permanently disabled.
Oh.
Because he was in an auto accident where his father was killed. And this was one of the tragedies. And we, through Mary Adair, do know her brother and his wife. They have one daughter. And she was here visiting. And her husband is a career man in the service, helicopter pilot. And they're living in St. Louis, and they were up here over Thanksgiving. So we had to see Penny, and we've never seen their children, but know of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm sure that our young folks are not getting near as much of this as there used to be. When we talk about these neighborhoods and concerning people to people, so forth, why, this life has changed. It is different. And we had a phone call yesterday, and I'm sure the only reason we had a phone call was that Russ had been to a hockey game in East Lansing, or in Lansing, the night before, MSU. And here was Ron Jorgensen from Beloit, who Russ had gone to school with. And they were buddies in high school and just and running into each other. But it still has meaning. And I'm sure that I went to school with Ryan's dad. And so these personal relationships that used to be a much greater part of life are not anymore, which is something that was rather precious that we don't have.
Well, I used to know, of course, everybody on the road here. Now I've got a new house up here, and I don't know who they are, and the next house up has been sold. I used to visit back and forth there. What's his name? Doesn't matter, but the family's divorced, and so forth. And then around the corner, of course, the post's up there, but I don't know any of the people who go. I guess a little farther along, I know some, but... there's no community here anymore.
The farmers used to help each other and work back and forth together as a family, more or less, but now each man has his machinery that he does the same thing by himself when he buys his crop is ready.
Lois is saying, that she's farther away, but she's saying that it used to be people would get together and help with the work, and now every man has his own big machinery and does it himself. What were you going to say, Johnny?
Has that been talked to in any of your conversations?
Not really, no. This is the first time.
Let's talk about it.
Yeah.
And with the thrashing, with the silo filling, with all of the final harvest work, why, it was something that you exchanged help with. And there would be one large harvesting machine, which could be a thrashing machine, it could be a corn shredder, it could be a silo filler. And it was sometimes cooperatively owned. Sometimes there would be two or three families that would share in the ownership of it. Sometimes it would be individually owned. And then this would be paid for, the service of this machine. But it would take more than one person or two people to bring the harvest to the machine and have it thrashed, or have it put into the silo, or have it shredded. Mm-hmm. A shredder was a machine that would take the bundles of corn, which were stored in shocks in the field. The corn was cut by a corn binder. Then it was shocked, and the shocks and the pumpkins, as we used to see them in pictures, were part of the landscape. Then when this...
Standing like teepees.
That's right.
Yeah.
Then when this was put into the barn, it was done with a machine which was a shredder. And the shocks would be loaded on wagons. They'd be carried to the machine, which would be beside the barn. And the shredder would do the same as a corn combine does today, except that it would do it in one position. Then the corn bundles would be fed into the shredder. The ears of corn would be taken out of the husks. They would go into a wagon, and the rest of the stalk and the leaves would be shredded and blown into the barn for fodder. But this would take a crew of men. This would take anywhere from 6 to 8 to 10 men. So you would exchange help in the neighborhood. Your neighbor would help you, and you would help him, and you would keep track of the time, and maybe you had some time left over from the exchange of thrashing so that you'd have some time coming.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was a way of life. It was much more organized cooperation through the need that existed in order to take care of the harvest. One of my early memories is right across the curve from where the old school was. I can remember that as far as I can determine, why, this was to pay taxes, this service. And you were allowed to haul gravel for residents in the neighborhood, landowners were allowed to haul gravel to pay their taxes. This was called a road tax. And the days were chosen, and then the farmers would take their teams and their wagons. And these wagons were made of dump planks. They were 4x4 timbers that were the floor of the wagon. And then there were planks that were put on the side and end gates that were put in the end. And these were loaded with a shovel.
Mm-hmm.
And they would go to the gravel pit, which was there, and they'd shovel these loads of gravel. Then they'd haul it out onto the road, and where the road needed to be repaired, then the gravel would be dumped. And the sides would be tipped over, let the gravel run out, lifted up, tipped over. Then the dump planks, the 4x4 floors individually would be lifted up and the gravel would shake down, and this is the way it was done. And it used to be called, you would work for your road tax. And I would guess that this was a credit that was given against the real estate tax the farmer had to pay. Hmm. I don't know. You could probably research this and find out.
Now, would this be the gravel pit on the Dogan property, or would that be the one right on the corner there that was the big scoop out there when I was a little kid?
That was a big scoop out. That was on Sam Mackey's.
And it was on Mackey's. That's the gravel pit you're talking about.
That was the gravel pit, yeah. Uh-huh.
It had to be fairly narrow.
4x4 is a chunky log.
You couldn't lift this.
They tip them up like this. And
pretty hard to lift a six-inch plank out of the bottom of a wagon with gravel on top of it.
They had sturdier outfits in Wisconsin. They had no more.
Well, that's awfully interesting. And, of course, I know about the thrashing cooperation because as a kid, the thrashing machine would come and there'd be the big meals at the big house there at the dairy. But the whole sense of cooperation, I haven't been around in recent years, and so I haven't realized that everybody does do their own work now.
I think why they do their own work now is because they have these combines that they just need when the grain is ripe. They keep the whole operation.
Lois is saying that they do all the operation at once with the machine. And also, nobody builds straw stacks anymore, so that the thrashing isn't done the way it used to be. I interrupted you, though, Lois. Did you?
Well, this is the change that's taken place in harvesting. And it's been through the innovation and the inventiveness of new machines, more efficient machines. Reflected in economics because if it's more efficient and more profitable and more effective in saving the crop to do it this way, well, this is the reason that it's happened. On the other hand, the only way the cost of investment today is something that would not have been conceived by people previously.
We didn't call them straw stacks. What would we call the conical stacks that we brought the sheaves in from the farm?
These were stacks of grain. These were stacks of grain. The grain was thrashed either from the field. When it was thrashed from the field, why the grain had been harvested with the binder. Incidentally, why the binder, a lot of the development and the perfection of the binder as a machine was done here in Beloit, so you can probably get some information from the Historical Society on that.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
It was. And the grain, at that point, it was after it was cut with the period when it was cut with a scythe, was previous to this, but then when it was cut with mechanical means, it was cut with a binder, which sheared off the stalk of the grain and formed the grain stalks into bundles, and then wrapped it with either a twine, which was knotted, and it was the knotter which was developed in the Beloit area. Mm-hmm. And some of the early binders used wire, which was unsatisfactory because that got into the thrashing machine. Then these bundles were formed into what were called shocks, grain shocks. Mm-hmm. And there would be, 12 or 15 bundles?
You get two of them together.
They would be set on the butts so that the grain was held up away from the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And these were formed, and then they were capped. There would be two bundles that would be put on top to protect the heads of the bundles underneath.
It would sort of shed the rain, wouldn't
That's
it?
That's right.
Uh-huh.
That's right. And then...
About how many bundles in a grain shock altogether?
Well, I think with different kinds of grain and different needs for dissipating the moisture for ventilation of the grain, I would determine the size of the shop.
Mm-hmm.
But you see there were different kinds of grain. There was barley, there were oats, some wheat and rye that were grazed.
Mm-hmm. You forgot bearded barley. Did you say barley?
I said barley. Right.
Bearded barley.
Oh, yeah. And then there were also... A different type of handling the bundles, which was hauling it into the farmyard and piling it in stacks. These were a conical type of a pile, which would have been probably about 20 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
And the bundles on the bottom were on rather a broad base, and the heads of the grain were faced inside so that they were protected against the weather. And then these were brought up in conical shapes. So
they lay on their sides?
They lay on their sides.
With the heads in and the butts out?
With the heads in and the butts out.
Okay.
And then as the stack was made, it was tapered so that they were cone-shaped when it was finished, and they would come almost to a point at the top.
Mm-hmm.
And this was to give them protection against the weather and for a longer period of time. Probably the reason for this was that in the early days, there were fewer thrashing machines. And so it was not possible to get the grain thrashed as promptly as it was necessary in order to keep it from spoiling and rotting.
So they'd bring the shocks in and pile them up into the stacks.
They would stack the grain in the farmyard in these cone-shaped stacks, large cone-shaped stacks, so that the grain could be kept for a longer period of time before it went through a thrashing machine.
Mm-hmm. And then when the thrashing machine came, they'd take the stuff off this cone shape.
That's right. The thrashing machine would be brought in beside. These would be set up in rows so that the thrashing machine could be set up beside the stacks, and the bundles would be thrown out of the stack into the thrashing machine.
Mm-hmm. And then
I can remember how proud I was when I was allowed to be a spike pitcher. The spike pitcher was the man that would stand on the edge of the stack and feed the thrash machine, and he had to put the bundles in head first, and he had to watch the machine so that it could handle what it was getting.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't put them in too fast.
Not put them in too fast, and not every once in a while, but occasionally the rumor came around that somebody's pitchfork had gone through a machine on somebody's place, and the theory was that pitchfork didn't slip. The boys wanted a rest, and they thought that Spike Pitcher had let it go through. I can't ever remember that happening at our farm, but it might have.
Tell me about a memory I have of either you or W.J. showing me how you fastened a grain bundle out of grain. You took it and you took the things and you bent it in a certain way, and it would make a belt around it and hold the grain shock. And you could put it around your waist, too, and have a grain belt. But there was a trick to it.
Oh, yes.
And I remember being taught this trick. Now, this would be hand shocking then, wouldn't it?
Well, that's hand tying the bundles.
Hand tying the bundles.
You see, as the binder would cut the grain, occasionally it would miss a bundle.
Mm-hmm.
And it wouldn't be tied. So here you'd have a loose bundle. But when you're shocking, you've got this loose bundle of grain, you have to do something with it.
Uh-huh.
And quite often, a man that was shocking grain would have through his belt, or if he has some binder twine strings.
Mm-hmm.
And he could just pull out a binder twine string and wrap it and tie it, and he had the bundle tied. But really, the old timers, the technique of expertise was just to take a bunch of stalks, which would, when compacted, would be maybe an inch in diameter or so, and
wrap the bundle of grain with these stalks, but the trick was to be able to tie them so that it would stay.
Yeah, that's what I recall. What I remember is something like that.
What it was was to wrap the head and the head of the, as they came together, the head and twist it, and then work it down underneath so that the pressure that you created with this band would keep it compressed into the grain so that it wouldn't unwrap. It was something that you could tie any type of knot that you wanted to, but it was something that you had to do in a hurry because you didn't have very much time to tie loose bundles with. Mm-hmm. So a person that could do that could just whip this around there, a twist of the wrist, and it was all set. And usually, the fellow that did it would hold on to that knot, twist it, make the knot, hold on to the knot and place that into the shock while the knot was still being held. But when you let go of it, it's where you wanted it anyhow.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember that
sort of
thing?
I remember my father being able to tie.
Well, maybe he's the one that taught me rather than you, but maybe you taught me.
He attempted to teach me, but I never mastered it.
Well, I don't know if I ever mastered it, but I think he tried to teach me, too.
Jackie, yeah. I have to tell you one experience. I mentioned it to your dad, and he says he doesn't remember it, but I remember it.
We've got quite a few things in the book that he doesn't remember.
And going back to the experiences when he was leader of the boys group, this evolved by we became more part of affiliated with the YMCA, the rural YMCA. And there was a YMCA camp over at Maquoneago.
Mm-hmm.
And we were going to go to the YMCA camp. And your dad made the arrangements and took us. This was in the back seat of one of the old Buicks, as I remember. But I don't remember any of the details, except that we had to stop in Clinton because Jay Green was a banker over there, and your dad had to see Jay Green because it seemed that we didn't have the money to go to Y Camp with, but your dad knew that Jay Green would see that we could go.
Mm-hmm.
So we sat in the sun over there in Clinton for quite a while. And for the boys that are, a little bit impatient, it was kind of a long sit in the sun and the old Buick with the mm-hmm. black leather seats, and these got hot, especially the buttons that it was tied with. But finally your dad came beaming out. He says, "Well, we're all set. It's all fixed." And he solicited along the way to camp the money to take these boys.
Now that was my father or me?
That was you, the YMCA camp.
Imagine that.
Well, that's a good story.
I knew that I'd attended Y Camp as a kid, and
you took us over. Bob Mack surely got homesick. His folks had to come and get him. I decided I'd pass my swimming test, even if I hadn't learned how to swim, and they had to fish me out. So there
Phantom
was,
Lake.
Phantom Lake, that's right. We were pretty young kids at that time. I don't remember how old we were. Also, your mother used to come along once in a while when they'd have the boys' meetings and Y meetings. My mother used to just love to have her come because she played the piano.
Mm-hmm.
And life in the country at that time was really, really lonesome. You didn't have anything except the party line on the telephone. And that was just about it. And your mother used to play the piano. My mother used to just love to hear her play Country Garden. And I can remember her playing, and I can remember how my mother was so thankful after she'd gone to Hurricane. She just loved that piece. And it's been a pretty changeable world.
Neat to hear.
We rotated these meetings among the various homes, as you know.
Uh-huh.
You knew about that.
Yeah.
They come down to our place, and the Johnny's, the Holmbecks, Maxworthy's.
You've heard about the hot hand.
The hot hand.
Hot hand game?
No.
Don't you kids know about the hot hand game?
Tell me about the hot hand
Hasn't
game.
Hasn't Grandpa told you about that? He hasn't. Let's make him tell you about it.
No.
Well, I tell you, I'll give you a demonstration. I'll give you a demonstration.
Odd man up.
I'll give you, who shall we let Grandpa be hit? I'll tell you how it works.
I've been sick lately.
I'll tell you how it works. This is just about the right formation, not quite. But you take a kitchen chair, which is, it's a good, solid, stiff-back chair, and you put it up against the wall, and as big a room as you could get it in, and then all of the group would form in sort of an arc back here about halfway across the room. And the one that's it would lean down in a chair like this, so-called with his eyes closed, usually put a blindfold, be sure. And then somebody in the group would step up very quickly and just get a nice time delivery. And get more stuck up high and back. And then the one that was it would guess who didn't agree. And if he didn't guess, he got another one. And if he did guess, the one that he guessed would be it. And your dad used to love to play hot hand. Oh, how he loved to play hot hand.
I was probably bigger than most of you kids at that time.
Yeah, I know you had longer strides. You came in with more speed. And I've never seen hot hand played anywhere else. Never heard of it from anybody else. Do you suppose that your granddad could have originated that?
It's the sort of thing you might have thought of.
Of course, if he hasn't told you about the fraternity experiences that he had, why? If he has, why? You can perhaps see where it came from.
I can remember Bob Maxworthy getting pounded so hard and for so long that
he was a bad guesser, wasn't he?
Practically cried.
Yeah, he was a bad guesser. Another time I can remember, we went to one of these meetings, and we didn't used to have roads like we have now. They used to be impassable, and impassable means that the ruts got so deep that the wheels wouldn't work anymore. And when we used to go over to Jim Anderson's, over to Howland's, over
Howland,
south,
yeah.
Why, we used to go through some of these impassable roads. But your dad had a brand new 1927 Essex, and that would go through most anything. And we used to get out and push, and Ron would gun it, and we'd go through the ruts in the 27 Essex. Remember that?
I remember the Essex. That was a machine that that Nona, Vera's mother, bought for herself. She couldn't drive, and she was somewhat crippled. And she was living with us. So as a result, without humiliating us by giving some expensive present, why she wanted us to drive her car. And that was the Essex.
Is that the one that maybe I was, the day that Grandma died or her funeral, I was sitting on the running board of a car, a picture was taken of me, I was about 3 years old.
Could have been.
Because I don't remember Nona, but...
That was.
Was that the Essex that I was on the running board of? Or was it the old Chandler?
It doesn't matter.
But there is a picture of that car somewhere. Well, that's interesting to hear this club work, because I've heard a little about it, but I haven't heard it in nearly as much detail as the sorts of...
Uh-huh.
Thank you. It's delicious.
Was it? I thought it was in front of the house.
Well, the mothers all were so good about entertaining us and giving us cookies and good things to eat and rather substantial meals when kids came in.
Oh, this was the only phase of activity that these kids that were becoming teenagers had any exposure to.
This was their social life, yeah.
That's right. They went to school,
when I got to high school, I didn't know the difference between a bourbon and a, mm-hmm. I mean, very definitely. And I don't know how I got there, but you had to write an examination. So I went to high school.
Did you have to go to Janesville to get take your examination?
I believe so.
I did.
Yeah, I believe so.
I think I flunked about half of them. Then I came back home and tutored with my
cousin Hazel Croft. Tutored.
And then went back and then passed the examinations when I went back. That's how I got into high school.
Well, when I got into high school as a freshman, why, I didn't know anything about sentence structure. I didn't know a verb from now. And I'd had a pretty good time going through grade school, but I had kind of a natural aptitude for spelling. Spelling was always fairly easy for me.
That was tough for me.
And I guess I could do enough arithmetic so that it satisfied the exam. Sometimes it.
Well, when I taught school in this little school, I was the last teacher that taught in this school. Some teacher quit in February, and that was the year I was out of high school and staying home for a year. So I went over there and taught for about 3 months. And I remember I had an awful good time with the kids teaching them sentence structure. You know, draw the line and cut it here and the noun here and the verb here.
Diagramming sentences. You love to diagram sentences, you told me.
Sentences.
And then they took the bus the kids into town on Collie Road at that point, didn't they?
After school.
Todd's school. Talking about neighborhoods, my experience was that we were, as kids, on the edge of the country neighborhood and on the edge of the town neighborhood. And I never really felt quite comfortable with either neighborhood. You see, we lived in the country, but we went to Todd's school. And so the real country kids were the ones that went to Zilly School or that were at the other country schools. The few of us.
Still being operated.
What?
They were still being operated.
Yeah, well, Zilly School was still being operated all the time I was growing up. I remember when Esther Meach came into ninth grade. She'd had 8 years at Zilly. And then she came into Roosevelt Junior High School and came into ninth grade there. Very bright girl. And Zilly went on for a while after that, too. But then I'd come out here and be...